Well, let me turn now to these further dependencies, starting with the dependence of the division of labor on exchange and money. We discussed a couple of cases in connection with exchange before the break. This fact that each party has to desire that which he receives from the other above that which he gives to the other. And that is known as a double coincidence of wants. But it's very often difficult to achieve a double coincidence of wants. Just consider, you want the groceries that you regularly buy in your grocery store, but to what extent does your grocer, do you think, or the farmers who ultimately supply him, to what extent do they want the kinds of goods and services that you're producing or helping to produce? Where do you think you'd be if your only means of obtaining groceries was by the offer of whatever it is that you yourself produce or help to produce? You wouldn't be able to do it, would you? I mean, think how many of you are working in some line, perhaps of international trade, or your product or services is sold elsewhere in the United States, or maybe just elsewhere in Orange County, away from where your grocery store is. Well, if we were living in conditions in which we were just bartering, offering goods for goods, most people would not be able to live doing the kind of work they're now doing. Certainly if you were producing something like ball bearings, sulfuric acid, steel girders, that would not be a means of your being able to obtain groceries, because you don't have grocers and farmers requiring these things, or at least not very often. If we didn't have money, if the phenomenon of money didn't exist, the division of labor would be a tiny fraction of what it is. The only way you'd be able to be sure of living is either yourself to be a farmer or to do the kinds of things that farmers regularly and frequently needed, like being you might be a blacksmith or possibly some kind of veterinarian. But otherwise, you would not be able to count on a food supply. Now just think of the tremendous benefit that the existence of money provides to the ability to develop the division of labor. All you have to do is keep in mind that money is something that everybody in a society is eager to accept. It's the one thing we're all eager to accept in exchange for whatever it is we're offering. Well, that means that instead of having to concentrate on producing whatever it is your particular suppliers may want, which would be extremely limiting, instead you're able to concentrate on producing anything that any significant number of people anywhere in the world want and have the willingness and ability to pay money for. Why? Because once you obtain money from them, all you have to do is turn around, and whoever you want anything from will be delighted to accept your money. So instead of your having to produce what your suppliers want, which would be incredibly limiting, you can produce what anyone anywhere wants who has money to spend, and then you turn around and you are supplied by your regular suppliers. You haven't had to supply them. You've supplied third parties. You've gotten the money from third parties, and now your suppliers are happy to take the money. So notice the tremendous increase in the extent of division of labor. Instead of each having to work and do things that his particular suppliers want, we do anything that anyone anywhere in the world with money to spend wants. And then we're supplied by anybody. So this is under the heading of the radical increase in the extent of the division of labor that is made possible by the existence of money. And closely related to this, the fact that money and money prices exist, that we have money prices for virtually everything, this provides the intellectual guidance. It's the basis for the intellectual guidance of the Division of Labor. It tells us what we should be doing and how. Just think, because there are money prices for the products being produced and money prices for all of the inputs used to produce them, it's possible to compare the value of the product with the value of the inputs and to know if the process is being carried on gainfully. So imagine that we didn't have money and there was something being done in a complex process of production. Let's say it's the question of constructing some type of factory to produce equipment used in iron mining. Okay, you have the different materials to construct the factory. You know how much services of machinery of different types you'll require. You know how much in the way of labor services of different kinds will be required to construct this factory. This would be a physical enumeration of all of the means of production required. And then there'd be the resulting factory. Well, how would you have any idea if this was a worthwhile process to carry on? How would you know that it's worth building this factory? You really couldn't tell. You'd see one set of physical inputs, you'd see another physical output, but you wouldn't have the means of judging whether this was actually something worthwhile to do. But when you have money prices for the means of constructing the factory and the monetary value of the factory that will result, then you're able to make a judgment. Is the product of greater exchange value than the means of constructing it? And if it is, that's a profit. If it isn't, that's a loss. And you know what to do. So money and money prices make possible, as I put it, economic calculations and thus economic comparisons. We calculate the money costs of production. We can see the money value of the product. We're comparing them, and we judge, is the process worthwhile doing? We can compare different methods of production. Almost always there's more than one way to accomplish something. And how would we know which way to go? Well, the fact that they all have money prices, that they'll add up to different overall costs, that gives us a guidance. Other things being equal, we go with the lowest cost method. We know what to do. We can compare the profitability of different products and know which ones we should be working on, which ones we should eliminate. We can compare the profitability of investing in different branches of industry and know where to increase investment, know where to decrease it. We can compare the remunerativeness of different jobs and know, other things being equal, which one to work in. In other words, without money and money prices, we'd really be at sea. We wouldn't know what we should be doing. But with the money prices, we do. And it's not just that this provides some kind of arbitrary method of keeping score, as it were. It's actually an objective basis for behavior. Because if we do want more wealth, which we certainly do, in the context of a monetary economy, increasing your monetary wealth is the means of obtaining more goods in exchange. So if you start out the year with, let's say, $100,000 of capital, and you can finish the year with $110,000 of capital, unless the buying power of money has fallen quite sharply, the $110,000 will enable you to purchase more than did $100,000. And similarly for any other possible case, whatever yields the greater money income or represents the lowest money cost, that is enabling you to achieve more by way of the process of exchange. So it's actually a valid guide to what to do from the point of view of serving your material self-interest. And without it, as I say, we'd be at sea. And then, of course, without money, the division of labor would shrivel to people being farmers or blacksmiths and veterinarians, essentially. Now, a few words on this next major line of dependence, the dependence of the division of labor on saving and capital accumulation. What I refer to in point one, the initial rise in the productivity of labor in agriculture. Before there can be any basis for division of labor, it has to be possible for less than 100% of the population to produce food for the whole population. If we needed everybody's labor just to grow food, then everybody would just be a farmer, and that would be the end of the story. Before there can be work in doing things other than food production, we have to make it possible for less than the full labor of the society to provide the food for all. And that initial rise in the productivity of labor in agriculture was achieved by virtue of people engaging in some degree of saving and capital accumulation that would enable them to produce more. A classic example, another example that you can read in Boehm Bawerk, the same guy as the pioneer, who wrote about the pioneer with the five sacks of grain. Well, an example he recounts from a still earlier author is a case of primitive fishermen. And let's say they're living by gathering fish washed up in tide pools. And maybe they can gather a handful of fish a day in this way. But if it were possible for some of these fishermen temporarily to get by on less fish, abstain from as much consumption. Let's say they had been, on an average, gathering three fish a day with their hands washed up in tide pools. Imagine that they could subsist for some period on just two fish a day and devote one-third of their labor perhaps to producing some sort of boat and net. And this might take them, I think in the example, 100 days. And so they'd have, at the end of this period, they'd have constructed a boat and net. And now with the aid of the boat and net, they could go out and catch 30 fish a day, or some substantially increased quantity. Well, notice this degree of saving and construction of further means of production raises the productivity of labor. It could also be you devote a little less labor to gathering fruits and nuts, and some labor to producing some sort of primitive implement that will enable you to produce more later on. So on such a foundation, it becomes possible for the productivity of labor in agriculture to become somewhat greater. And this means that not as many people are required in agriculture, and now there's a basis for some people moving into some other lines. Jumping ahead into the context of a modern economy, the role of saving and capital accumulation in connection with the dependence of the division of labor, a major role is under the heading that I describe as the division of payments, the division of payments. Just think how many different stages in production we have at which payments are made. Think for a moment of the total process entailed in making automobiles. What steps, directly or indirectly, enter into the production of automobiles?
Materials procurement.
Pardon me?
Materials procurement.
Okay, there has to be materials procured for the automobiles, but first those materials need to be produced, right? Okay, there's a production, has to be a production of steel before there's a production of automobiles, a production of the rubber, and before there's a production of steel, what does there have to be?
Mining.
There has to be the mining of the iron ore. And before, I mean, I guess at some early primitive stage, before there was the production of iron ore, maybe you didn't need the production of much else. If you had a very rich vein of iron ore, someone might scoop up some with his hands. But we got beyond that early on. So what sorts of things would need to be produced before the iron ore? Okay, equipment. At the earliest time, a shovel, perhaps. And now today, before we mine iron, we're producing quite sophisticated iron mining machinery, right? And but what do we have to do before we produce the iron mining machinery? Okay, we need a factory from which the iron mining machinery comes. And in order to construct that factory, what did we need?
Materials to build the factory.
Presumably earlier iron and steel, and still earlier equipment. Now, as if you start thinking about the production of anything, I guess, there's an implicit history in the production of every good. First, the materials from which it's made had to be produced. Any prior materials, the equipment at the different stages, the materials to produce the equipment, other equipment to produce those materials. It goes on back. We can probably trace the history of each good back to the days when the first caveman made the first tools. Everything keeps going back because there's earlier tools, earlier materials, etc. All right, well, we don't have to push it all that far. Let's just stop and consider when people buy the final products. Let's say someone today is buying an automobile. Now, it might be that he pays cash for the full price of the car. Occasionally that happens. But what's a more common method of buying cars?
Finance.
You finance it, and then you can pay for the car over several years. It's common now, I believe, to pay up to 5 years, and maybe even longer. But certainly a five-year loan is not uncommon. Three-year loans are very common. Now, what does this imply, just this one circumstance, what's implied about the time interval that goes by between the performance of the labor in an automobile factory to make a particular car and the time when that car will be fully and finally paid for? It could be up to 5 years. That's not uncommon. Here we are. Someone is doing some work in the auto plant of helping to assemble the car. His work is embodied in this particular car. It ends up in a dealership. Someone buys it, and the buyer doesn't finish paying for it for 5 years. Well, how many workers do you know who'd be able to work in an automobile plant and wait 5 years before they were fully paid for their labor if they had to be paid out of the proceeds of the sale of the product?
None.
Okay, now even if the car is paid for in full at the dealership, how much time goes by between the performance of labor in the auto plant and the sale made and payment received by the dealer?
3 to 6 months.
It can be several months, right? Now, how many auto workers can wait even those few months? Well, not very many. And then if you look further, what would be what's the waiting time between the labor performed in the steel mill that will help to produce the steel that goes into the particular car that might be paid for at the dealership? That's significantly longer, isn't it, than the wait of the auto worker. And what's the time interval between the iron miner's labor and the payment for the automobile at the dealership level? That's even longer. And then what about the time interval between the performance of labor to make equipment that's in the auto plant, which might be in use in the auto plant for a period of quite a few years? And what about the labor to construct the auto plant. And the auto plant might be in use for 50 years if you had to wait for the resulting products, if that had to be the source of remuneration, well, the workers involved at that stage would have to wait 50 years or more before they could be fully and finally paid. So I'm pointing out there are major time spans that go on in the production of things. Well, how often, how long do people have to wait, in fact, before they're paid?
2 weeks.
The average worker, I think, is paid within 2 weeks. Well, what makes it possible for the average worker to be paid within 2 weeks when the ultimate final product that he's contributing to will not be paid for as a minimum for months, and in many cases for years, decades, even generations?
Capital.
It's capital. It's the capital. There's the funds available to be laid out today as payments before the receipts from the product come in. A capitalist possesses funds that he uses to advance, to buy materials, equipment, labor, and these funds are paid out in advance of the sale of the resulting products. Now, an iron mining concern has capital. It uses some of its capital to buy iron mining equipment, employ the iron miners. It is paid for its iron ore, perhaps within 30 days, maybe a little bit longer. It gets payment within that time. It can afford to meet its payroll, buy its supplies, and so on, before its capital is depleted or run or totally exhausted. It's taking in revenues, but it has to have the funds to advance in advance of taking in funds. And then, what is the source of payment to the iron mine? Where do the funds come from to pay for the iron ore? From the capital of the steel mills. And so the steel mills possess capital. They're expending it for iron ore to pay the wages of their own employees, buy their own equipment, etc. And then they are paid within 30, 60, 90 days by the automobile companies. And the automobile companies have to have their capital. So there has to be capital at all of the different stages of production. The availability of the capital makes it possible for the different parties to be paid all within a reasonable time of the performance of their work or the sale of their products. They can all be paid within a reasonably short time, even though the ultimate products that are resulting, such as the automobiles, they may not be paid for many months, years, or even generations. Well, what would happen if we didn't have capital? If we didn't have the saving to provide it?
Loans. Get the funding from banks or financial institutions.
You say, where do banks and financial institutions get their funds? Are these the great majority of the funds?
From public investments.
From the savings accumulated by private individuals, right? So it's still capital and savings. But my question is, suppose we did not have savings to provide the capital.
Payment would have to wait.
Pardon me?
Payment to the individuals would have to wait.
People would have to wait, but are they in a position to wait?
No.
They're not in a position to wait. So could we have any extensive division of labor in a vertical succession of iron miners, steel workers, auto workers? If the requirement was everyone had to be paid within a short time, but there is no capital, then what sorts of things would we be able to produce?
No.
We'd only be able to produce things that could be achieved within the very shortest spans of time. See, our remote ancestors, the early cavemen, how were they living?
Day to day.
They were hunter-gatherers. They would have to find food within a short time. They could spend their time roaming through the forest, picking berries and nuts, going on a hunt. They would, if they succeeded, they'd be able to eat. Now, let's say they have a successful hunt. They bring down a big animal, and that animal will last them a few days. Well, what have they got to bring in before that animal is exhausted and the fat on their own ribs is exhausted? They've got to have another animal. So their period of production is limited maybe to a week, 2-3 weeks. I think a human being can go up to 30 days without eating if he's been able to eat sufficiently in the past. So for our primitive ancestors, their period of production was on the order of a little over a month. They could have a successful hunt. They could eat off the hunt maybe for a few days. Then they could live on their own accumulated body fat for a while. But then the yield had to come in or they would die of starvation. Now, I don't know how long this took, but at some point we got to the stage of agriculture. But in an agricultural society, you have a harvest essentially once a year. Certainly before modern times, you'd have a harvest in a given area of once a year. And if the harvest was abundant, then it hopefully was sufficient to enable people to live until the next harvest. So that would already imply the existence of greater accumulations, greater savings and capital. But to go still further, then they had to be using some of the labor made available to produce further tools and implements, then apply better tools and implements to the production of agricultural products. So in order to advance, we have to be able to adopt more time-consuming methods of production. And in order to do that, we need to have available greater savings and capital. And saving and capital are essential, as I say, to developing the division of labor in its vertical aspect of a temporal succession of one step following another, and to construct buildings and machines that last many, many years. All right, let me turn now to the dependence of the division of labor on economic competition and the freedom of competition. We're going to have some further discussion of competition about 2 weeks after the midterm, thereabouts, and I'll then attempt to show that what economic competition is actually all about is, as I put it here, the organization of the division of labor. It's what organizes the division of labor with respect to which persons land in which jobs. It's a process of competition that decides who will be company president and who will end up being janitor. That's a process of competition. And of course, which companies will supply which markets to what extent, and which products will supply which markets to what extent. And also, which technological methods will be used to what extent in the production of which products. These are all issues determined by competition. And we'll see that competition is not at all a process of dog-eat-dog, survival of the fittest, etc. It's survival of the fittest products and methods of production, but not the perishing of unfit people. It's not survival of the fittest people at the expense of less fit people. It's actually a process that enables everybody to survive longer and better, because it is succeeding in organizing the division of labor. Let me try to put it this way. Have you ever heard of a dichotomy or purported dichotomy between competition and cooperation? Have you ever heard anyone argue, instead of competing with one another, we should cooperate with one another?
Yes.
I think that's a fairly common attitude. Well, what I'm trying to say here is, if we think about the division of labor, the division of labor is the one great process of social cooperation. When we work in the division of labor, we're cooperating with one another. Just think the fact that there are people out there doing so many specializations from which we all benefit in our capacity as buyers. We're performing our specialization from which other people benefit. What is this but a process of social cooperation? Now, competition is the process of organizing this process of social cooperation. Competition is the process of organizing the division of labor. It's putting the right people in the right jobs, determining which products will serve which markets, to what extent, and which methods of production will be used. And in this process of organization with respect to people for jobs, as we'll see, there is room for everybody at the appropriate level of ability. It's not that the fittest survive and the weak perish. The best qualified might become company president, and then less qualified people become other things, and the very least qualified, well, maybe they end up as janitors. But there's room even for them. And they benefit profoundly from the superior ability of people in the higher positions. All right, well, further, point two, competition plays a vital role in connection with the division of labor in providing protection against the exercise of arbitrary power by the companies or workers of any given industry. Just think how many vital industries there are, without any one of which the economic system would be largely paralyzed. What could we achieve if the trucking industry stopped functioning? That would cause incredible devastation. All right, suppose the trucking industry is rolling along okay, and the problem is the electric power industry. What kind of economic system can we have without a functioning electric power industry? That would be utter destruction. And the same is true of many other industries. The oil industry, or say it's not the oil industry, then the steel industry. And I'm sure we can think of many, many other industries. Well, competition operates to prevent such a thing from occurring. Because there's competition in the different industries, it's not possible for an industry to hold up the rest of the system for ransom. If any one company doesn't want to produce, there are others willing to take its place. If any one group of workers doesn't want to work, there are others able to do that work. But where the where free competition is eliminated, then it does become possible for any vital industry to hold up the rest of the system. Okay, let's turn to the next and final major area of dependency, the dependence of the division of labor on the freedom of economic inequality. And this would apply to production even not under a division of labor. My first point is forced equality and the destruction of causality in production. See, in order to have anything produced, we have to leave people free to be motivated to produce as much as they can. They can only do that if they are free to achieve unequal results and keep the unequal results. Let's start off by imagining we had a small voluntary commune consisting perhaps of just 10 people. And the arrangement is each member contributes his paycheck to the commune. All right, suppose you're a member of this 10-person commune and you find a way that you could earn twice as much money, but it means you'd have to work an awful lot harder. And you'll have to contribute your double paycheck to the commune. Well, how much would you increase your own income by virtue of you succeeding in earning twice as much.
One-tenth.
One-tenth. You'd increase your income 10%. Well, you might decide, okay, you'll still do it. And especially if you like the other members of the commune and you wanted to be able to improve their conditions too. If you have, if the other members are your wife and eight children, then you'd almost certainly be willing to do this. But let's enlarge the commune now. It's not 10 people, all of the others of whom you like or love or at least greatly admire. Let's say it's 100 million people. It's the rest of your fellow citizens of a good-sized country. All right, now you increase your contribution to production. You make it, you double it. To what extent can you increase not only what is going to you personally, but what is going to any other specific individual that you value, such as your spouse or children?
100 million.
1/100 millionth. By your contributing double, you can improve your well-being 1/100 millionth. You can improve your wife's or husband's well-being 1/100 millionth. That of your infant children 1/100 millionth. And that's it. Well, is that a perceptible improvement? How does that differ from your not being able to do anything? Insignificantly. So here you are. You have the physical capacity to produce some significant result, doubling your personal productive contribution. But when you have to divide it by a denominator of 100 million, to what extent can you achieve any beneficial result? Not just for yourself personally, but for any other individual whom you value. Are you able to accomplish anything of benefit to you or anyone you value when you have this large group commune? No, you can't. That's why I refer to it as the destruction of causality in production. Here you are, you're able to do something, but you cannot accomplish a beneficial result. Your ability to accomplish a beneficial result is destroyed by the division of the result by this massive denominator. Now, under such an arrangement, whereby everyone has to divide his income, the benefit of his contribution equally with this massive collective, does anyone have a motive to do any more? Is there any motivation to accomplish any more? There is no such motivation. But on the other hand, suppose you could get away with doing nothing. How much would you reduce what's available to you or any other individual whom you loved? If you could get away with it, you'd do nothing. You'd spare yourself the strain and effort. So the incentives of people are not to do any more, but to do as little as possible. Well, if that happens, what happens to the whole productive arrangement? The whole thing would collapse. There'd be nothing produced. Well, what's necessary to prevent that?
Threat of force.
The threat of force. You'd have to say, everybody must produce some minimum. There's some prescribed quota, or else. So this kind of arrangement results in forced labor. It's a system of slavery. It has to be a system of slavery, because there's no motivation for the individual to produce. And for some reason, so many people think that this is a kind of social ideal. They think economic equality, that's the ultimate ideal. But that would be an absolute, utter disaster. Now, I have a second point here, closely related. It is a little bit of a digression, but it's a significant one, I think. And that's the destruction of causality and cost, e.g., socialized medicine. The same principle of dividing something by an enormous denominator, reducing the outcome to virtually zero, This, I think, goes a long way in explaining what has happened to destroy, or what is going on, destroying medical care in the United States and many other countries. Because all you have to do is apply the same principle of collectivized outcomes. In this case, instead of collectivized income, collectivized cost. Let's imagine that when we all leave here, we'll go to some nearby restaurant, maybe Houston's, I guess, a block or two away, and we'll have lunch, and we'll go on the following arrangement. Everyone can order anything he wants from the menu, and then we'll get one check, and we'll share it all equally. Now, this is a small group. I think maybe there's 17 or 18 people in the room, and you're all classmates. All right, now imagine, compare the influence of ordering under this arrangement with the situation in which each of us has to pay his own check. If you know you have to pay your own check and you're looking at different items on the menu, let's imagine they have hamburger, $7.95, top sirloin steak, $17.95. Well, you might prefer top sirloin to a hamburger, but maybe you can't afford the extra $10. So in that case, you order the hamburger. But what if we were going to split the bill 17 ways? Now, your extra $10 raises the group cost by $10, but how much does it raise your personal cost when the check will be divided 17 ways? Well, it's the $10 divided by 17. That's something greater, I guess, than 50 cents. Maybe 60, 70 cents or so is the increase in your check. And as far as you're considering price, what has happened to the influence of the higher price on your readiness to order? Yes?
It's gone down.
It's gone down. Instead of being $10, it's $10 divided by 17. Not much more than 50 cents. Well, now imagine we have, now in a class, many of you know each other, hopefully you all like each other, and so you might be thinking, okay, I could do this, but I don't want to screw my fellow classmates. And there might be some people in the class who, if they went alone, they would order the steak, they can afford it, but maybe they're thinking, many of my classmates aren't as well off as me, I don't want to sock my steak to them. So because they would have to pay for it, I'll only order the hamburger. That could happen. So some people might behave that way. But let's say they did, only there are some others in the class who don't. So the check comes around, and here you are. You didn't order the steak. You ordered the hamburger to go easy on everybody else. But you see, well, that guy over there, he ordered the steak. I didn't, but he did. So I'm paying for his steak. If we repeated this next week, what do you think the result would be? Then everybody, the people who had held back, they would jump in. All right, now imagine we don't have a small group where people would be influenced by personal considerations for others. It's a huge group, 100 million or more. What's the extra cost of practically anything? An extra $100, an extra $1,000, an extra $10,000, it's going to be divided 100 million ways. What's the extra cost to the individual?
No.
It's insignificant. Don't bother thinking about it. Well, that is the situation under socialized medicine. Under socialized medicine, the idea is the medical care will be free to the patient. The patient doesn't have to worry about the cost of the medical care. So whatever you medically need, that's what you'll get, and you don't have to pay for it. Well, somebody has to pay for it, and that will be the general public. Well, just think, whatever the procedure, maybe it's something that's $50,000, maybe it's more, what is the incentive of everyone insofar as he's a user of medical care under that arrangement? Get as much as possible. There's no cost to the individual. If anything is of any benefit, irrespective of its expense, why not get the benefit? Because it's costless to you. But if everybody proceeds like this, or if enough people do proceed like this, what happens to the overall total cost and then the average cost?
Skyrocket.
They both skyrocket. It would be the same thing under our group ordering. If we all ended up ordering steak, that would be a much higher cost to those individuals who normally would have ordered something less. Well, if we have medical care under the arrangement that everybody can get anything they want and it's costless to them, well then practically everyone will attempt to obtain everything that might be of benefit, and the result is there's an immense cost. Everyone will end up with a very high cost, but it won't be tied to his individual use of the system. It's tied to his status as a taxpayer. His use or abstention from use of the system has no bearing on his payment. So the incentive is to use it without limit. And how do you think it affects the perspective of the physicians?
They don't want to be involved
with it. Pardon me?
It doesn't, a physician doesn't want to be part of something where they're not rewarded for.
Well, let's say at first they'd be rewarded. The physicians are getting rates, and we'll say the government is going to pay them. Up to now, it's been private individuals paying their own way, but now the government will assume payment and pay the physicians in place of the private individuals. And initially, it starts off, the government is paying the physicians comparable to what they would have received from the private patients.
They have no motivation to use discretion as far as what procedures they'll do.
Okay, the physicians, they're looking at things, and all they have to look at is what could be a benefit to the patient. All they have to do is look at what might be better off, what might be better medically for the patient. They don't have to consider the patient's means. And there can be tests, procedures. If the patient can derive any benefit from this, well, why not go ahead and do it? It's no cost to the patient. Now, also, incidentally, we don't have to make too much of this, but it should be mentioned. You can be sure that there are many, many physicians who would also have an eye on how much additional revenue they, the physicians, would receive. It would be of some medical benefit to the patient, and not incidentally of some significant financial benefit to the physicians. So that seems like a very nice deal. And what would you expect to be happening to the number of tests and procedures and hospitalizations going on under this arrangement? Okay, it would certainly increase. Now, there's really no significant difference between what I've just described and our system of private, quote, insurance, unquote. The size of the groups is not the whole population of the country, but we have many, many medical insurance groups with huge memberships, millions of subscribers. And the way this system has worked is to remove incentives to economize, not perhaps quite as greatly as I've indicated with a full socialized system, but substantially. If when you need to see a doctor, whatever the doctor's charge might be, it's only $10 or $15 out of your pocket. That is not the same kind of deterrent as if you had to pay the full price. If the doctor orders a test for you, well, if you merely pay a certain percentage, that still might be some deterrent, but there are many plans where you don't pay anything, so it's zero deterrent. And the modest percentage, 10% perhaps, sometimes 20, that's not as much of a deterrent. So what do you think should be happening to medical costs under these arrangements? They should be rising. So I think this is the fundamental explanation of why medical costs have risen and continue to rise. And it explains other phenomena. Like you often hear that the claim made that the cost of medical care goes up because of advances in medical technology. I think that's a common claim, right? Do the price of computers go up? Does the price of computers go up because of advances in computer technology?
No.
No, it goes down, in fact. Now, why is it going up in medical care? Why should it raise medical care? Well, what happens when there is an advance in medical technology and we have the system is built on the premise that the patient is entitled to the best standard medical care available. That's his right. He has a right to the best medical care available, and the insurance company must pay for it, or the government will pay for it, whichever the arrangement is. Yes, Ms. Fox?
I guess what I want to clarify is what you're saying is the patient obviously is only paying a copay. Yeah. They're not paying the full amount of their service, right, and they're going to increase. Yet if you look on the managed care side that's paying the physician, they're cutting what they pay them, so to reduce costs,
yes,
to reduce,
yeah,
the number of tests.
Right. Okay, that's a very good question. Ms. Fox is saying that the managed care programs and also Medicare, they're cutting what they pay physicians, and they're trying to control expenses. This is where the system ends up. It gets to this point, but it starts out with medical care either being free or at a radically reduced cost, and you get what you want. And for a number of years, people like physicians, they're doing very, very well. Hospitals are doing well. But the budget is getting out of sight. Now, imagine we had an arrangement. This will be the deal. An utter stranger will be responsible for paying for your lunches. Then we start out, you just go in anywhere you like and you order what you want. How long do you think it'll stay that way? I mean, what are you to the utter stranger? Does the utter stranger have any real motivation to say, well, I really got to be sure that Miss Fox gets the lunch that she desires? When we get to that point, in the long run, even though if it starts out that way, in the long run, where impersonal strangers are in charge of the spending for people, if we were talking about their lunches, do we think that they would end up with a diet of sirloin steak and baked lobster, or something closer to dog food? I think they would end up closer to dog food. And you see, the government, the insurance companies are out to restrain what they pay to the doctors, because the basic system, in the absence of such restraints, the system would operate. The doctors would just be socking it to the insurance companies hand over fist. Maybe they'd be offering legitimate medical care of some benefit, but far beyond what the patients could actually afford. So the insurance companies need to turn around and restrain that. And that's why they're controlling it. And then the same with Medicare. This is the movement from the steak to dog food. That's what we're in process of doing with the HMOs, because there's an unlimited claim on them. And for the same reasons, the insurance companies and the government, what attitude must they have toward advances in medical technology? Let's say here we are, there's some new procedure. It can be used to save a life. A few years ago, when multiple bypass surgery came into vogue, what do you think the attitude of the insurance companies was toward bypass surgery? They're terrified by it, because suppose here we are, we have a procedure that might cost $50,000 or whatever, and the arrangement, the system is operating on the principle that everyone is entitled gratis, or almost gratis, to state-of-the-art medical care. So here's something that's coming out to advance the state-of-the-art, and it's hugely expensive, and all of a sudden everyone will want it. Well, what does that do to the expenses of the insurance company or to the government's budget if it's footing the bills? It'll send it way up. So what is their interest with respect to such an advance. Do they want to see it appear, or would they like it not to appear, to be classified perhaps only as an experimental procedure, which they were not obliged to finance? I think obviously the latter. Now, in a free market, if we had free medical, free of government interference, not free of price, in a free market, there could be bypass surgery introduced, and initially, only extremely wealthy people could afford it. It would be beyond the means of most people. They'd regrettably be out of luck. But then what would you expect to happen to the cost of the procedure as more experience was gained and people started thinking about it further, simplifying it? It would come down, it would become affordable to more and more people, and then people would live longer for less. It would be on the order of the kinds of improvements we get elsewhere, like in computers. Now, when a new computer processor appears, the top-of-the-line processor, what kind of price exists on the most on the currently most advanced personal computers? That'll be the top-end price, right? And then when something further is introduced, that starts coming down, and computer prices have fallen incredibly. But suppose we finance the purchase of computers the way we finance the purchase of medical care. Suppose we had an arrangement, we have computer insurance. When you need a computer, you'll have a modest copayment, or maybe no copayment at all. The government will provide us with new computers at no cost to ourselves. Well, here's a new 3.6 gigahertz chip or whatever. What do we want now? There's this new, more advanced computer. Wouldn't we all want it? What would be the effect of this arrangement on the costs of providing computers? It would be out of sight, and technological advances would be raising costs further. Instead of reducing costs, they'd be raising costs. You see, the whole problem with medical care and the effect of advances in medical technology on costs, it's because of the way we're paying for it. We're paying for it under a collectivized arrangement. And the tremendous administrative costs, the bureaucracy, that is a further derivative, the efforts of the insurance companies and the government to prevent themselves from being ripped off without limit. Mr. Underwood, then I'll get to you, Mr. Zink.
So, with the healthcare industry,
yeah,
you're saying that this guy can't afford better care, so he doesn't get it. But doesn't that pose the ethical question?
Okay, now,
how does that fit into the scenario?
Okay, here's someone, he can't afford the better medical care, and he wouldn't get that care. Doesn't mean he wouldn't get any care, and there are people who might not be able to afford anything. The traditional solution in such cases was charity care, and physicians typically saw patients who couldn't afford to pay, or perhaps they charged them much less, and in some cases not at all, and similarly with hospitals. That's virtually disappeared now, and it would take quite a while to reconstruct. But you see, that is a problem, but we also have people who can't afford food. What is the solution for people who can't afford food? Pardon me?
Well, they have food banks.
Well, that can be part of the solution, but is the solution for the government to take over the grocery stores and farms and collectivize the payment for food?
No.
No. Okay. There's a problem for some people, and the way to address that problem would be through private charitable efforts, and until that could be done, then some transitional arrangement could be made. But it shouldn't be that that problem governs the character of the whole system.
But if I am, so you're saying the response is charitable organization?
Yeah, ultimately.
But in a capitalist society, if I am out to improve my wealth,
yeah,
how does the charity fit? Because charity is giving away my wealth and not increasing my wealth. It only increases my inherent desires.
Okay, now under capitalism, it's the pursuit of material self-interest under freedom. But anytime we want to acquire wealth, we don't want to acquire wealth as an end in itself. We always want to acquire it for further purposes. Like part of your wealth is your automobile, but you don't want the automobile just to have it sit there, presumably. You want the automobile because of what it can do for you, right? Okay, now, are we interested in any way at any time in the conditions of other people? Personally, truly.
Yes.
I think I may have given this example. We go to movies, we read books, right? And we see and read about characters that are not personally connected with us, but we can profoundly sympathize with their plight. So some innocent victim is about to be murdered, and we're terrified, perhaps, and we want the police to save the victim, and we're deeply emotionally involved. Or some innocent person is suffering through no responsibility of his own, and we would like that person to get out of that situation. So we do have sympathy for people in straitened circumstances and facing severe hardship, and doesn't that benefit us in some way if, to some limited degree, we can help them? And you might want to acquire some wealth for that purpose. This is not sacrificial. I think it's positively satisfying. It makes us much happier if we didn't have to see the sight of suffering children through no fault of their own, if we could do something that would improve their condition. That's something we'd want to achieve from the point of view of our own self-interest, properly understood. But there are limits to it, and so we might contribute a few percent of our earnings that way, but not the totality, not the majority, not a huge proportion. So I think that there is a basis in self-interest for some limited, reasonable degree of charitable help to other people. But that's been essentially destroyed, and the more we collectivize the society, I think the more that gets destroyed, because then we tend to view each other more and more as just out to gain at the expense of the loss of other people. Okay, and I would say also, incidentally, this will be the last thing I say in connection with the medical situation. The whole malpractice problem, all of these suits and the huge cost of malpractice insurance, I think this is a further derivative consequence of the collectivized method of paying for it. See, if we adopt the principle that each individual is entitled, irrespective of his financial circumstances, is entitled to state-of-the-art medical care, then whenever state-of-the-art medical care is not offered, what is it? How will it be construed? As some kind of malpractice. So that goes through the roof. And the way to get out of this quagmire, I believe, would be to start eliminating the third-party payers, introduce payment by the patient to the fullest possible extent. And one major step in that direction would be if the tax code were revised so that all of the employer contributions for medical insurance, as well as the present employee contributions, if both would retain their tax-free status, but be made tax-free take-home income to the workers. So you give every worker the option, or not just the option, mandate that whatever the employers are now paying to the medical insurance companies as premiums, that instead that, as well as what the workers are paying, that their medical insurance premiums now become tax-free take-home wage income. That would be one big step. Not the only step, but one step. This would greatly enlarge the number of non-insured patients. You'd have a large group of people who would not have medical insurance. Now, the first thought is, well, this would be absolutely horrifying. Everyone would be faced with these incredible medical costs. But at the same time, things could be done to very sharply bring down medical costs. What you could do is you could have legislation that the hospitals and the physicians in dealing with uninsured patients would be bound by a different, earlier set of rules pertaining to malpractice, a more liberal set. We didn't always have these malpractice problems. You could take the legal guidelines, perhaps the precedents prevailing as of some earlier period. I don't know what the cutoff date would be, but there would be a way to radically reduce the threat of malpractice suits and the cost of malpractice. And then additionally, and perhaps still more important, you could make it possible that say any three licensed physicians, if they're already licensed physicians, and any existing hospitals, they could decide to treat patients on their own terms. What is the cost of spending a night in the hospital nowadays? What's the bill, at least to the insurance company?
$2,000.
On the order of $2,000 a night. Now, there might be some cases if you're perhaps if you're in intensive care from some like the hantavirus or something like that. If you have some really bizarre condition, maybe that kind of cost is justified. But let's suppose that what you're there for is an appendectomy or you have pneumonia. I think these are the majority of cases. Does it really cost, do you have a real cost base justifying $2,000 a night? I don't think so. Have you ever stopped to look at the cost per night in a first class hotel? Not the super deluxe hotels, but a nice, good hotel. A nicer place to stay than most hospital rooms, certainly. Well, $400 I think would be quite high. I think you can get certainly around here. Pardon me?
$200 to $400, depending.
I would say outside of places like New York City, closer to $200. I think you can stay at the LAX Hilton for less than $200. And that's a reasonably decent place. Well, if you look at the cost of good hotels and then calculate, well, we would need round-the-clock nursing care. Okay, how many nurses on a given shift do you need per patient? Maybe one nurse per six patients or something like that, or maybe it's 10 patients. You would allow for those things, a physician available, and suppose you had hospitals that wanted to concentrate on the more or less run-of-the-mill, relatively uncomplicated illnesses, pneumonia, appendectomies, etc. What do you think would be the, and they had free competition, like say any three already licensed physicians could open such a hospital. You start off, the prevailing rate is 2,000, but if the actual costs incurred in operating the facility were on the order of 200 a night per patient, what do you think would happen to the rates? They would plunge. And then the hospitals would have to be developing methods to become more efficient and have lower costs, which would permit further reductions. You could have more computer-operated monitoring systems and so on. So maybe you could use fewer nurses per patient and do it just as effectively. But the point would be that medical care could be made radically more affordable. And then you can take some further steps. Some steps have been taken. We have the phenomenon, I believe, of assistant physicians. This is something above registered nurses, but still below a physician. And that serves to increase the supply, that takes some pressure off. What about going a little bit further? There are other people with substantial competence in some areas of medicine. How about licensed pharmacists? Why not, at least in certain cases, maybe not for narcotics, but for many other things, allow them to to skip the prescriptions or write their own prescriptions. In the past, like in The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith observes that the poor man's physician is the apothecary. That, of course, is the pharmacist. So what we would want to do is increase the supply of medical services. That would help bring down rates and bring down these incredible hospital rates. So in other words, what I'm trying to say here is I think the way to move is in the very opposite of the way we are moving. Instead of going to the single-payer system a la Canada or Britain, we should be undoing the collectivization of medical care that we've had. Yes, Mr. Noble, is it?
Yeah. I see what you're saying under that model with the more typical generic.
Okay.
Cases.
Yeah.
But wouldn't that same model drive the price to be outrageous for like a brain tumor?
Well, I think that already is outrageous.
How would a normal person be able to pay for that?
Okay, now.
Yeah, there's true specialty doctors.
Okay, yeah. All right, now, you see, there would be a proper role for medical insurance, but not to meet routine medical expenses if you have medical catastrophes. So I would assume you could get a policy that would cover certain types of brain tumors, certain rare types of cancer, whatever, but you'd have to get the policy when you had no indication that you possessed such a thing. And you'd have a very, very high deductible. And there is some high deductible major medical insurance available out there. And a possible step in the right direction is to go with such insurance. And that's accompanied also by proposals for medical savings accounts. So you could save to cover the high deductible, and those savings would be tax would be a tax deduction. So that's a related way to go. Now, if the question is, suppose there's someone who has a medical condition that will cost $10 million, and it's beyond his means, beyond any ability to insure against it. Well, I know this is a very terrible situation for the person and his family, but in that case, this person will just die. And there are times when there is no way around it.
So you're saying that even though our technology has progressed, I'm just trying to... Yeah. It seems like there could be some contradictory messaging here, because our system has progressed to elevate, the technology has facilitated a higher level of health and lifestyle, and that's a positive factor of capitalism. The negative factor is it might not be beneficial to everybody if they can't afford it.
Well, it is beneficial to everybody, but you see, there's no system that can be devised whereby anyone can be made immortal. And there will be some conditions that are going to kill everybody sooner or later. Now, it might be possible to prolong life a little bit longer, but suppose the individual has to pay. Let's imagine here you are, you're 85 years old, 90 years old, and maybe some things could be done so that you could live another few years. And you're worth perhaps several million dollars. And maybe you could actually afford it. But then you'd have to, maybe that's what you'll do with your money. It's your money, you might do that. But I wouldn't be surprised that there would be many people in such a condition, if even to live means they'll still be largely bedridden, or they won't be able to do very much. They'll just be able to spend a few more years having to be walked to the bathroom or whatever. And they won't have very much of a life, and they will then leave their children and grandchildren with nothing. I would say they might decide that it is not worth spending that much money to go on for those extra few years. Or they might.
Well, what about the opposite? What about a 30-year-old male who has children?
Okay.
Who has a particular form of something that might not be bedridden?
Okay. All right. Let's say that. There's a 30-year-old man, and let's assume he could actually be cured. but it would be at a huge cost. Now, certainly if he has the money, if his family has the money, that's probably what they would want to do. And maybe there would be many people around who would be willing to contribute if this is rare enough. But then I would say you would also have to think that if you're asking other people to pay for it, that maybe they just wouldn't consider that as important as doing whatever else they're doing with the money. I mean, we actually have these situations confronting us every day. And I would say the way that we are all behaving, as we demonstrate with what we do, we're keeping the money for ourselves. We don't have to look just at the 30-year-old man. You've seen ads on television. It costs just $1 a day to help a child in Africa or whatever. They'll have fresh water and so on. Okay, there are many people, I guess, who are contributing $30 a month for that purpose. All right, maybe some of you are. That's fine. Well, why don't you contribute another $30 a month, a second or third or fourth? And if you've seen the program or you've seen the ads and you're not contributing at all, what does that say about your preferences as to how to spend your income? Pardon me?
I've got more important things.
Okay, there are things that you judge more important. Now, you see, I think this relates to the question raised by Mr. Wilson last week about interpersonal marginal utility comparisons, that the money to the richer person is less important than to the poorer person. But from the perspective of any given individual, your satisfactions, satisfactions at a far lower degree of importance are still more important to you than satisfactions of other people at a higher stage. And that's why, even though we might save other people's lives in different parts of the world at a reduction in our own standard of living, we value the marginal element of our standard of living above what would save the lives of these total strangers. Now, that doesn't mean we are totally unconcerned with them and would not want them to succeed, but we're not prepared to interfere with our own lives to do that. We wish them well, we might give them something, but there's diminishing marginal utility applies to what we would give them. And I would say if you want to give them the best gift, it should be something to promote sound economic policy so that they could achieve prosperity on their own. And I know some people may judge that as harsh and cruel, but try to think of the alternative. Suppose we had an arrangement whereby everyone's life is harnessed to every life-threatening emergency of anyone else anywhere in the world. And nothing can be done. We can't do anything until every 30-year-old father is guaranteed his recovery, until every hungry child everywhere in the world is guaranteed good food. Now, we would like them all to have this, but to what extent are we prepared to work as farm animals yoked to having to pull them toward recovery? I don't think we are.
Well, the medical emergencies is obviously where it's a great laboratory to look at ethics in action. Mm-hmm. However, you know, the same kind of forces operate in poverty-stricken areas. And why don't we have poverty insurance? I mean, if I lose my job, shouldn't everybody else take care of me? And that's when you get into tied to everybody.
Well, we do have
death happens, but that's when you start evaluating. What's the value of life? My father died. He said, you know, I can stick around for a couple of months, but it's really not worth it. And that's where a man makes a decision for his own life. And like a 30-year-old man, that has a illness that's going to be financially devastating to everybody. Is it fair for him to say you guys have to?
It's not fair for him to say. And just to be clear about my question, I mean, I sit to the right here, but my question is like all these arguments seem very black and white, right? They seem to be one extreme or the other. And I think in a civilized society, you know, the answer is somewhat in the middle, maybe a little bit more to the right than the middle, but still in the middle. There seems to be a certain, like if we're truly gonna be, I'm not talking bleeding heart altruism, I'm not talking about burdening the system unnecessarily. I think that there need to be limitations.
Yeah.
But I think that if we are to leverage this better life, this better technology, this better economic infrastructure, there has to be some trickle-down effect that would fall into the category of socialized benefits without the inherent burden and undermining of a capitalistic market economy associated with it. So, I mean, I guess the only problem I have here is the fact that I agree, but not all the way over to this extreme.
Okay.
I definitely don't agree with this extreme. And it just, in the argument, I'm not seeing anything even remotely in the middle.
Right. Mr. Kumar, did you want to say
something? I kind of agree with what Mike is saying.
I'm sorry?
I kind of agree with what Mike is
saying.
Agree,
yeah.
In India, it's like a medical fees are paid by the...
That's good.
In India, where I'm from, the medical fees are paid from our own pocket.
Yeah.
So I have seen the extremes, people abuse the system. For example, when you walk into the doctor's office, the doctor gives you a prescription for, okay, blood test and all kind of tests, which you really don't need.
Yeah.
So people abuse to just make money. On the other side, where here, you know, the system of the insurance companies abusing the system, you know, for a one night is $2,000. Tylenol costs $60, you know, in a medical bill. You know, I kind of agree with the middle, coming up the middle ground is the right way to do. And also, you know, one other comment, it happened to my colleague.
Yeah.
They met with an accident on I-40, and my friend's colleague's wife got paralyzed below her neck. And the insurance company refused to pay the adjustment fees.
Yeah.
So finally, after 3 months, she was in the hospital. After 3 months, the insurance company said, no, I can't pay anymore. Then my colleague, they had to relocate to India. So even if the medical fees is going to cost $1 million, that's when the insurance company is not going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a limit.
There's a limit.
Yeah. Mr. Zink.
Yeah, even outside the ethical question, even an economic question, is one thing that I think people promote health insurance does is motivate people to seek medical attention sooner, get medical procedures that will increase their health, you know, and if it's cost prohibitive, that maybe they would skip steps that would keep their health, which ends up costing more in the long run when they get more severe type of conditions. And also, you know, affects the economy and their, you know, their decreased productivity.
Yeah, well, there certainly are cases like that, I'm sure, that where people have to pay for medical care. Maybe they'd skip going sometimes when they really should go. Mm-hmm. So that can happen. But I think the additional demand where it's not as necessary or as appropriate outweighs that.
I have a question to make. Taking your model that you just explained in favor of non-socialized, under that circumstance, you have fewer individuals who are actually consuming high-tech medicine. So if somebody's producing a good or service for a profit, which is what their motivation is to be in business, it seems like under a socialized system, they'd have more incentive to make profit versus the system that you're prescribing, there wouldn't be as many takers or purchasers of this.
Okay.
And so, I don't know, do you end up with like country club medicine?
No, no.
You know,
all right.
Do you see my question?
Yeah, I see. Mr. Wilson says he thinks that under the collectivized system, there'll be more customers for high-tech improvements because everyone will want it. And so it'll be more profitable to produce. And in the absence, under the individual paying, the demand is less, so it won't be produced. I think the outcome is really the opposite. When something is new, it's high cost, and only a small market exists. But there will be a market, some market. And then once the high end of the market is served and experience is gained in the production of the thing, the costs come down, the price comes down, the market expands, and then the benefit becomes generalized. And we have all kinds of historical precedents. The automobile, when the automobile first appeared, it was as expensive as a yacht today. And so it was a rich man's toy. But that gave the industry its start, and then look where we got. Now, I think the same would be true with medical advances. Some would begin as extremely costly procedures that for a time only a small number of very wealthy people could afford. But then the costs and price would come down and the general quality of medical care would be improving. When you have the socialized system where everybody is deemed to have a right to the state-of-the-art medical care, then you might have an isolated case where if they follow through on that and they say, okay, here's this new very expensive procedure and we're making it available to everybody, well, maybe that would be a more powerful incentive. But the government is not going to do that for very long, nor the insurance companies. And so what is their actual attitude toward the advances? Because they're bound to give them to everybody once they approve them. So I would say that's a system in which the advances will not be
possible. So initially it's privatized underwriting on this, but the benefit is for everybody as time goes.
As time goes on, you see, things start out in general as luxury goods with a small market, and then their cost gets brought down and they achieve a wide market. And so the regular state of medical care improved and would go on improving. But if the government takes control, then possibly you might have some initial benefit, but the longer term result will be very bad. And I think we have an illustration in the making in connection with the president's prescription drug benefit. It may be that the drug companies are in favor of this because they think, well, now the federal government will be picking up the tab for millions of extra doses of their pharmaceuticals. But what do you think the next step will be when politicians and editorialists start commenting, well, why is the government spending billions in buying these medications? Look at their profit margins. Where do you think the drug companies will end up with this arrangement? I would say it'll be where the doctors are already. The government will be cutting the fees. And then what do you think will be the effect if the pharmaceutical companies don't have huge profits that finance drug research? What will be the effect on the next generation of drugs? Ms. Fox.
But don't we have the issue where right now with the pharmaceutical industry that patients are getting their drugs from Canada because it's a lower cost?
Yes, that is going on to a considerable extent. And I think that what makes that possible is, my understanding is, Canada's medical system is essentially a socialized system. And so the Canadian government, in effect, sets a price of pharmaceuticals in Canada. The drug companies make a profit, but they don't make the kind of profit you would make normally on patented innovations. They make a much lower profit. And now, if we adopt the same system, well, then we get the current generation of drugs cheaper. That would be true. But what is the source of the financing of the next generation of drugs? It's the high profits on the current drugs, and the high profits on the next generation of drugs is the motive to go ahead and develop them. So if you have a system where the innovations are going to be compelled to be priced in a way that only allows you to make an ordinary common rate of profit, what are you doing both to the incentive and the means of financing the development of further advances? I would say that's short-sighted. And the appropriate solution would be that Canada should change its system too. Ironically, there was an article, I think in yesterday's New York Times, about medical care in Canada. The premier met with some of the heads of the provinces, and the federal government of Canada has agreed to pour in another $60 billion into their medical system because they have increasing waiting lists, waiting times for all kinds of procedures. And the state of medical care in Canada is not to be envied by us. I mean, our own system has many problems and is getting worse, but from what I understand, theirs is worse than ours. Okay, I think you're all pretty hungry and are eager to get somewhere else, so I'm sorry we had to have this makeup class, but it was necessary. I thank you all for coming in. Have a really good day. And on Monday, I think you should bring with you both supplement 3 and 4. We may be getting into 4 too. I hope we will. So have a good weekend.
Thanks, Father Zona.